KALW.
From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents, context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I live in Bayview.
Outer Sunset.
I live in Bernal Heights.
St. Francis Wood.
La Lengua.
Coal Valley.
Alemany Boulevard.
Coming up, we'll hear about a San Francisco law firm's $20 million lawsuit in response to a trans woman's death in ICE detention.
Border agents told Medina that she was, quote, not trans, and that she was, quote, a man.
Then we'll revisit the contested sainthood of Junipero Serra.
If he was a saint, he wouldn't have brought on all of this devastation and genocide to all of these people.
And what's happening in the Golden State Warriors offseason?
We didn't win a championship, but I hope we represented this community appropriately, even in losing.
The latest from our podcast, Bounce, and more coming up on Cross Currents. Johanna Medina León's family says she left El Salvador out of fear for her physical safety because she's transgender. She died of pneumonia about a month after U.S. immigration officials took her into custody. Her family claims Medina was repeatedly denied medical treatment, and a Bay Area attorney just filed a $20 million wrongful death claim on their behalf. KLW's immigration reporter Teresa Katsarilis is here to walk us through this. Hey, Teresa.
Hey, Hannah.
So let's start with the basics. Why are women like Johanna Medina León seeking asylum in the U.S.?
Right. So the majority of people seeking asylum at the U.S.-Mexican border right now are from the Northern Triangle in Central America. Mm-hmm. So that's Honduras, El Salvador, and Guatemala. These are three of the most violent countries in the world. They have three of the world's highest homicide rates. And according to Amnesty International, at least, LGBTQ people are particularly vulnerable to this violence. According to the Medina family attorney, Johanna Medina León fled El Salvador for this reason. She was physically threatened over her gender identity.
Mm-hmm. And Medina was detained at the U.S.-Mexico border.
Right.
Why was she detained?
Right. So basically, if you present yourself at the U.S. border and ask for asylum, U.S. immigration authorities will put you in a detention center. That's been the rule since the mid-1990s, at least.
Mm-hmm.
Asylum officers then hear detainees' cases and decide whether they have a good reason to fear returning to their home countries. And at least in the past, if asylum seekers passed that test, then they were released into the U.S. while they awaited for a judge to properly hear their case, which, of course, can take years.
You said in the past.
Yeah. So Medina wasn't released. Mm. And attorney Amy Kirby told me that Medina's family has a lot of questions about this. Medina seems to have done everything right here. She entered Mexico legally initially. She was granted a humanitarian visa. And then she entered the United States legally. She presented herself to U.S. authorities and requested asylum at the border. And then an asylum officer found her fear of persecution to be credible.
Everything seems to be going right.
Right. She's doing everything right, but she wasn't released after this official found her fear to be credible. And her family's attorneys say they still don't know why. The Trump administration is trying to keep more asylum seekers in detention for longer to deter people from coming here. So the big picture is that that could have been a factor.
Okay. And so then what happens to her when ICE takes her into custody?
So before I go into that, I just want to note that all of this information is coming from Medina's family's attorneys. Mm-hmm. ICE has declined to comment on the specifics of this case.
Okay.
So according to their attorneys, we know Medina was housed with male inmates at Otero Detention Facility in New Mexico. That's an all-male facility. According to LGBT rights advocates who were in touch with Medina at the time, border agents told Medina that she was, quote, not trans and that she was, quote, a man. Medina then became quite ill in custody, and according to her family's attorney, ICE denied her medical care at least four different times when she requested it.
Mm.
Medina was actually a nurse, and her family says she became so desperate that she requested water, sugar, and salt so that she could make her own IV solution and treat herself. ICE ignored her request again.
Ugh.
Yeah. This is all alleged, just to be clear. Officials took her to a medical center a few days before her death. They released her from custody the same day that they took her to the center. And Medina died of pneumonia on June 1st, the first day of Pride Month.
That's very shocking.
I know.
What does ICE have to say about that?
So An ICE official released a public statement and said that, quote, this is yet another unfortunate example of an individual who illegally enters the United States with an untreated, unscreened medical condition. I want to emphasize that this public statement is inaccurate. Medina did not enter the U.S. illegally. ICE since revised that part of the statement.
Right.
And they're essentially blaming her for being sick before she got here.
So how unique is this case?
Not very, unfortunately. Just to go big picture for a moment, Medina is far from the first person to die in immigration detention. Civil rights groups have been issuing reports on the dangerously substandard medical care in these facilities for years and years. And at least 24 people have died in ICE custody since Trump took office. Now, at first glance, this death rate actually looks about the same as it was during the worst years of the Obama administration. But the total number of immigration detention deaths is higher. The NBC number doesn't include people who died in detention with other federal agencies like Customs and Border Patrol, for instance. Medina is also not the first trans person to die after being held in detention. Almost exactly a year ago, a Honduran refugee named Roxana Hernandez-Rodriguez died in ICE custody. Mm-hmm. Civil rights groups have also protested the treatment of trans detainees at the very facility where Medina was held.
The same one.
The same one.
Okay, so now what is Medina's family asking for?
So they're demanding $10 million in damages for the injuries that Medina suffered in custody, and then another $10 million in damages for her wrongful death. So mm-hmm. this is a $20 million claim. They're also demanding the release of all records pertaining to Medina's death, which is, I think, equally important because they want to establish exactly what happened here
right.
publicly.
Yeah. So what is next then? What are we following?
Well, the Transgender Law Center organized a protest in front of the Otero detention facility yesterday, so this is heating up in activist circles.
Mm-hmm.
The government has 6 months to respond to the Medina family's claim, and the family's attorneys say that the family plans to sue if this claim is rejected. And this is one of several lawsuits over the deaths of detainees in ICE detention.
Okay. Well, we'll be following with you. Thank you, Teresa.
Thanks, Hannah.
Teresa is KALW's immigration reporter. Connect with her at immigration@kalw.org. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. Last week, Governor Gavin Newsom delivered a public apology.
We apologize on behalf of the citizens of California to all California Native Americans for the many instances of violence, maltreatment, neglect, murder inflicted on the tribes.
He talked about the importance of teaching the truth about California's dark history, establishing a first-ever Truth and Healing Council for California Natives to clarify the record and get their perspectives in the history books. For many people, this raises the question of what will be done about the story of state icon Junipero Serra, whose canonization was protested by Native American activists back in 2015. That's when reporter Lila Day looked into the true story behind the man known as a saint, but considered by many as a sinner.
Native American activists in various parts of California have held protests against the Pope's plans to make Junipero Serra a saint.
If he was a saint, he wouldn't have brought on all this devastation and genocide to all of these people.
That's Karina Gould, a member of Indian People Organizing for Change. She's talking about the effects of the mission system, a key part of the Spanish colonization of California. Missions were constructed to spread the word of Christianity. 21 of them stretched from San Diego up the coast of San Francisco. And Junipero Serra was the driving force behind their founding and expansion.
So many people in the Bay Area that grew up in California learned about these mission systems, that they were these great things that came and helped the Native people. They never talk about the truth of what happened.
That truth includes some uncomfortable facts. After the Spanish came in the late 1500s, the native population declined, and fast. Prior to colonization, California had an estimated 300,000 American Indians, and by 1900, there were only about 15,000. Much of this was due to disease brought by the Spanish, but life on the missions was also brutal.
You had to live by their rules, so you didn't get to speak your own languages anymore. You weren't able to practice religion or sing songs or do any of the things that you would regularly do. And then you had to go by these bells. For us here in Oakland, we are right across the street from a church that plays bells at different times of the day. Those bells remind me of the bells that called my ancestors 6 a.m. to wake up and to begin prayer, and at noon to stop and to eat. But it was all of these things that you were learning these things by the bell.
Native Americans that did submit to Catholicism were baptized. By law, they were under the authority of the Franciscans, and some of the mission's documents prove they were whipped, beaten, shackled, and hunted down if they ran away. The Vatican is aware of the controversial history. At a town hall speech in Bolivia, Pope Francis apologized for what he called the sins of the Catholic Church. I humbly ask forgiveness, he said to the crowd, not only for the offense of the church herself, but also for crimes committed against the native peoples during the so-called conquest of America. Still, proponents of Serra's sainthood say the injustices of the mission system should be seen in a historical context, that Serra was a product of his time. His own papers include the words, spiritual fathers should punish their sons, the Indians, with blows. But it's also documented that Serra strongly voiced his opinions about military expeditions against Native Americans, and he resisted climbing any academic ladders, preferring to spend his time with the people he believed needed the Catholic Church. This notion that Native people were needing foreign help makes someone like Ruth Orta start to boil.
On my land, I'm going to call this my land because it is. On my mom's side, this is my land. I've never left. I'm still here.
Orta is a volunteer here at the Coyote Hills State Park in the East Bay. In her free time, she volunteers, doing things like teaching people how to harvest acorns, the traditional way that her ancestors did.
See, this one is cracked open. This one's no good. But this is what they look like. Oh, yeah, it's got bugs in it.
Orta is short. She walks fast and wears a gold cross around her neck. She's Catholic, and she's Native American.
I'm Ohlone, because that entails the whole San Francisco Bay Area. So that's what I am, but I have little different things in me.
Even though she's Catholic, she has no problems opposing the canonization of Junipero Serra.
What they did, and what the man, Junipero Serra, allowed to happen, even though there's books saying that he was this and he was that, he was nice, he was good with natives and all that. Well, if he was, he should have stuck behind him and talked for that goodness in what he was supposed to be doing.
So do you feel torn at all being Catholic and being against this?
No. I know what I believe, what I think. I'm not torn about decisions.
This park that Orta volunteers at has a lot of historical relevance. It used to be an Ohlone village site. Outside in the marshland, birds are chattering. Orta tells me that she's looking forward to her Sunday in church. When I ask her how she's going to feel when she's asked to pray to Junipero Serra, she says she has a simple solution.
Just turn it off. Just skip over. God knows what I feel. So he'll know. I have faith that when I die, I am going to go to my Creator. Yep.
For others, it's not that simple. Some have faith that Junipero Serra is worthy of sainthood, and some don't. But one thing the canonization has brought to light is the complicated and contested nature of our state's history. For Cross Currents, I'm Leela Day.
There are still symbols of Junipero Serra all over the Bay Area, including a busy boulevard on the southwest side of San Francisco.
Thank you.
You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. Well, the Golden State Warriors offseason is underway. In one of their last moves in Oakland, the team introduced its three draft picks at its convention center practice facility. The newest dubs are Jordan Poole, Alan Smilagic, and Eric Paschal, who said,
"I actually told my parents during this whole draft process I wanted to come to the Warriors."
Well, yeah, they're good. The draft is the first of a series of events that'll shape the future team, but while the new players posed for the media, the vets have other things going on. In the latest episode of Bounce, the Warriors' last season in Oakland, KALW's Ben Trefney has more.
We're going to focus on the Hamptons Five. That's Kevin Durant and the four players who flew to the Hamptons a few years back to convince him to join the team. First, Stephen Curry. He's definitely using his celebrity. Last week, a documentary he executive produced was released. It's about the Charleston church shooting. He also went to Japan and China, where he made several appearances for Under Armour, the brand he endorses. And he played golf, according to his Instagram feed. That's also where you could find an ad for something else he's into.
Holy moly! The most intense, exhilarating, and downright dangerous putt-putt ever played. Oh.
From executive producer Stephen Curry.
This is the biggest competition in the world.
All right, that's probably not why he won the Sportsman of the Year at the BET Awards Sunday night, but that happened too. Then there's Draymond Green. He traveled to Warren, Michigan, just north of his hometown of Detroit, to open a fitness center, so that's nice. Also, apparently, he's still hungry. Friday night, he tweeted, quote, "I ordered some food on DoorDash 2 hours and 15 minutes ago. Estimated delivery time was 26 minutes. I'm still waiting for my food, and they offered me a measly $10 for the inconvenience. Trash-ass app," unquote. On and off the court, Draymond's got feelings. Who else? Well, most valuable bench player Andre Iguodala. He released his autobiography, co-written with Carvell Wallace. In it, he tells the story of how teammate Klay Thompson says his favorite basketball moment ever was when he was about to shoot from about 50 feet away, and Iguodala said, "What the f*** are you doing, man?" Klay shot it anyway, and he made it, and he said, "F*** you, Andre." True story. Thompson, meanwhile, is scheduled for surgery to repair his torn ACL this week, and Kevin Durant is recovering from his own surgery to repair his torn Achilles tendon. Both players are free agents, so they may be hired away by another team if the offer's right. We're going to find out in the next few weeks. So Iguodala is promoting his book on the media circuit this week. He dropped this tidbit in New York on CNBC.
They'll have Klay back in around February, March. KD might miss the whole season, but for him, it's good to get away from the game.
You want to tell us where they're going to re-sign?
I think they'll both be back with the Golden State Warriors. We're like brothers. Wow. We keep in contact. But regardless of any of that, if both did decide to leave, they would still be my brother. I still keep in contact with them as much as possible. And I just wish the best for both of those guys. They come back full strength.
You're crushing the Knicks fans right here with this kind of
Nobody's going to the Knicks. Sorry.
Sorry, not sorry. Yeah, there are lots of questions to answer about who this team will be next year. It may not really resemble the one that's leaving the town. This is Bounce, the Warriors' last season in Oakland. I'm Ben Trefney. We're working on a story about the charity work the team and the players have done in the community. But today, we're going to take some time to hear from some of the players and executives themselves. I've always been fascinated by press conferences, the things that are said to push the story of that day's game forward. But those are just sound bites. There's something about seeing that person for the entirety of the conversation, the focus of so many journalists, something that helps you really get to know them as people, what they care about, what gives them character. So a lot of the attention on the team right now is on whether Kevin Durant, who's an all-time great, whether he's going to re-sign with the team. His right leg injuries were the enduring storylines from the postseason. People called him the best player in the league before he went down. Then he wasn't really around for quite a while. Except on May 24th, when the team made him available to the media during practice, it was about a week before the finals began. His eyes were bright in that conversation. He was excited to talk about basketball, excited to get back on the court. Looking back now, we know that playing again led to a career-altering injury. But at that time, it just seemed like he had a calf strain. Could have been worse.
The entire world seemed to be scared that it was very, very serious.
Did you, I mean, in the moment, did you?
Yeah, I mean, I seen a clip, and I mean, Reggie Miller screaming, that's an Achilles. That's an Achilles. I mean, obviously, everybody's going to be a little nervous until somebody reassures them that it's not. So, I don't know. I mean, I'm just taking it a second at a time. You know, every rep we in the, we doing a weight room, I just try to focus on that rep and not try to think too far down the line because, you know, I don't really know too much about this injury. I'm just leaving it to the hands of the team doctors, and I trust what they, the direction that they're trying to put me in.
Now that trust is in question, and the future of the franchise could depend on whether the free agent Durant feels his trust was misplaced. So with major injuries to key players, general manager Bob Myers is in a tough spot. His job is to craft and nurture the team. But now the foundation's shaken. At his end of the season press conference, his grounded perspective came through.
The odds are already out, Jimmy. You guys are not going to be the favorites. Is there any way in your mind you can accept almost a step back season?
I mean, it depends. I mean, people say, you know, we're done. And I never think of us as anything. I never thought, you know, people use words about our team. I just think we try our best. In my job's to kind of help pick the team. Coach coaches the team, players play. I've learned that, 2016, we were up 3-1. And if you had asked what are the odds of winning, they would have said 97%, and we lost. So odds, I don't know what our odds to win it this year were. We didn't. What are our odds to win it next year? I don't know. It's a longer, when I say long game, all this is a longer game than people think. I mean, I don't do this job for 1 year. I hope our players don't come here expecting to be here just for a year. I hope Steve Kerr doesn't expect to coach just for one more year, or Joe Lacob to own the team. The hope is to, and that's why I'm somewhat proud of this year. We didn't win a championship, but this community and this city, the entire Bay Area, I hope they're proud of what we represented. I hope we represented this community appropriately, even in losing. Because I always tell people, it's more important how you lose than how you win. And whatever adversity comes, I think you show more of yourself then. When you're winning championships and sweeping in the finals, it's great, everybody loves each other, but this is when you find out who people are, and I'm proud of how we conducted ourselves.
That's General Manager Bob Myers. While he's part of the brains behind the scenes, a lot of people say that the team's heart and soul is power forward Draymond Green. Here he is at his final press conference of the season.
Yeah, I think everybody thinks it's kind of end of us. That's just not smart. we're not done yet. You know, we lost this year. Clearly, just wasn't our year, you know. But it's how the cookie crumbles sometimes. But yeah, you know, I hear a lot of that noise. It's the end of a run and all that jazz. I don't see it happening, though. We'll be back.
Green will definitely be back with the Dubs in San Francisco next year. So will Stephen Curry.
I'll echo what Draymond said. It's kind of how do you respond and what do you, you know, how hard do you work to try to get back to the stage? You know, soak up this feeling because obviously we've celebrated, we've had champagne, we've had, you know, rings, but this is the more motivating feeling in terms of how do you respond? How do you turn the page to new challenges ahead? So we'll be all right.
Another guy who'll be back is Coach Steve Kerr. At his exit interview for the season, he was asked what he's looking forward to.
Well, I'm excited about the summer. I'm sure you guys all are. But I have no doubt I'll be refreshed and recharged and ready to go. I love this job. I love doing what I do. I love the working with the people that that I work with every day. So I'll be ready to go. But, yeah, I need a little vacation. And you guys do too. So
yes, thank
thanks
you.
For everybody. Enjoyed working with all of you this year. Thank you.
That's an excerpt from the latest episode of Bounce, the Warriors' last season in Oakland. Subscribe on your favorite podcast player and make sure you're subscribed already to the Cross Currents podcast.
I'm like my mother, I like to stay at home. Unlike my father, I prefer to work alone, to feel the pain and the boredom wash over me. 13 years ago, I got married. 3 years later, I began to run.
This music is by China from San Francisco. They're performing at Minnesota Street Project tomorrow night.
It's over, if she's gone for good.
Today's Cross Currents team includes Janae Darden, Jonathan Davis, Lisa Morehouse, Marissa Ortega-Welch, Drew Quinn, and Alice Wolfley. Our engineers are Tadek Foda and Gabe Graben. Content manager is Kristen McCandless. Our managing editor is David Boyer. Deputy news director is Angela Johnston. News director is Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.